Pleased to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Glad to have you along today as we begin our program by talking with Ken Kaufman. Ken's a legendary birding professional from Rocky Ridge, Ohio, field editor for Audubon Magazine, member of the American Ornithologists Union, author of several books on birds, butterflies, mammals, and insects. And his latest book is a memoir of his life's experience as told to his mom at her bedside in a rehabilitation facility in Wichita, Kansas. I've had a chance to read the book. I really enjoyed it. And I thought you might love to hear about it as well. So that's why we called Ken and asked him to be on, and he gladly agreed to do it. Ken, hi. Welcome to the program.
Oh, hi, Larry. It's good to be back.
Yeah, nice to have you back. By the way, let me remind you, if you'd like to join in with questions for Ken, you can do that at 1-800-642-1234 or in the Madison area at 263-1890, 263-1890. Give us a call with your questions and comments. I really enjoyed your book, and it's not only the stories that you tell about your tours and trips, but the way you weave the relationship with your mom into the book.
Well, thank you. It was something I'd been wanting to do for a long time, and the stories finally sort of came together. And my wife Kim was really encouraging me to do it as well. She'd read the individual pieces, and I had given a talk a couple of times that told the basic story, and she said, you know, you really should make that into a book.
Yeah, it's a great book, and I enjoyed it a lot. And early on in the book, you start sort of at your earliest ages. You learned to be a birder pretty early on.
Yeah, I was lucky. I mean, I was interested in all of nature as a little kid, and I didn't really zero in on birds until I was about six. But then after that, I tried to make up for lost time.
And you had a mentor that I remember reading in one of the chapters that you still remembered some of her comments to you. I don't remember her name. I can't remember her name. Oh, my goodness. But I also, and you may not remember it now right off the top of your head, but you were a member of a gang as a kid, Coxey's Army, if I'm not
mistaken. That's right, yeah. I had sort of a strange childhood because I was so wrapped up in birdwatching from the time I was six, but then that sort of thing didn't play very well in school. You know, at that time, being the best bird watcher in school wasn't, you know, like being captain of the football team or anything like that. So in school, we didn't talk about it that much. But I had a good friend named Jeff Cox and a couple of other friends. We formed this little group called Coxey's Army. And our main goal was to see if we could disrupt things without really getting in trouble ourselves.
Well, you know, and you write a little bit about the sort of the image or the stereotype of the bird watcher, and probably some of that goes back to the Beverly Hillbillies, and was it Miss Hathaway? Was that the
That's what I've been told. I actually never watched the program, but I have friends who still blame the image of bird watching on the Miss Hathaway from Beverly Hillbillies.
Yeah, and but I think that image is changing or has changed over time. Don't you agree?
I think it's gradually changing, and so it still has a little ways to go. But we're working on it. And there were a couple of stories in this book here that were aimed at trying to help nudge the stereotype along in a different direction.
Hell's Birders comes to mind.
Exactly. when I encountered this biker gang of birders called themselves the Thrashers, which is also the name of a kind of bird.
Yeah.
And then another chapter involving an encounter with secret agents who were bird watchers. I just like to expand the public image of bird watching a little bit.
Coming in from the cold. That was hilarious. a hilarious story. Oh my goodness! Now, did your parents encourage your birding activities as a youngster?
My parents were wonderful. I had three brothers and. We all wound up with really strong interests, and my parents were not, you know, they weren't especially interested in birds or nature at the time. They got interested later on, but they encouraged anything that was any kind of learning, anything that we wanted to pursue. that had any kind of educational value, they were always encouraging about that.
You know, I was really surprised. I was thinking about myself at the age of 16 and whether or not my parents would have let me take off on an around-the-country trip. But your parents did.
Yeah, and, you know, I didn't realize at the time just how unusual that was. A number of people have pointed out to me since. I'd been doing quite well in school. I was in honors classes and things, but I was just so rabid about birds. And we were living in Kansas, which is a fine state, but there are a lot of birds that don't live there. There are a lot of, like, you know, northern forest birds that you'd have in northern Wisconsin, or coastal birds, et cetera, that you'd never see in Kansas. And so I wanted to go travel around and see if I could find some of those. And amazingly enough, they actually gave me their blessings to go ahead and do that.
Yeah, I thought, man, that must have taken a lot of strength on the part of your mother to let you go.
Yeah, it really did. And, you know, of course, as I said, I didn't fully appreciate that at the time. My parents got a lot of criticism from friends and relatives who thought they were making a terrible mistake. And so later on, when I started to get established as, you know, as a nature writer and so on, whenever I had something published, my parents would just quietly send copies to to all the friends who had criticized them for what they did.
Oh, well, you obviously didn't spend your whole life on the road, because you don't really write about this in your book, but you must have gotten on for, I just would like to know, your own education beyond your 16 years.
Well, it's, let me put it this way. I'm the only person I know who has an honorary high school diploma. I actually never went back to school in a formal way. Most of my adult life, I've lived close to either some university or some museum or some other big institution where I could use their library facilities and go to seminars and classes. And I've actually taught a couple of classes at the university level, but I haven't taken the classes. So I happened to be back in Wichita, Kansas, where I had dropped out of school about the time my fourth book was published, and I was giving a program at the big nature center there. And the superintendent of schools came out, and they had a ceremony and gave me an honorary high school diploma.
Well, I don't think you need really to go back for formal.
But I do tell people, whenever I have a chance to talk to young people, which happens a lot because we've got an active group here in Ohio called the Ohio Young Birders Club, and my wife is the adult coordinator of that, I always tell kids the situation has changed. The whole educational system is very different now from what it was when I was in school. And if I were a teenager now, I would certainly go ahead and, you know, at least get a bachelor's degree and maybe go on for an advanced degree.
Yeah, well, I think you've probably gotten the equivalent of a post-PhD degree in what you've learned about birds and mammals. And certainly that's been you've got the equivalent of some pretty good, or better than, I should say, master's theses and maybe PhDs in your writing. So,
well, thank you.
I don't think you really have to give any excuses on that. Brian in Lake Geneva has a question for you. Brian, hello.
Hello. I was actually calling for some advice on hummingbird feeders. We set out hummingbird feeders, and we have recently discovered that what I've been told are orioles have been feeding out of them and kind of taking them over. I was wondering if they're going to drive the hummingbirds away, or if we can keep them, you know, kind of simpatico together, or should we try and get rid of the orioles?
Oh, you shouldn't try to get rid of the orioles.
Wow. Well, you know, in general, orioles are harder to attract than hummingbirds, so
yes,
you're lucky to have them. This is just about the time the hummingbirds are coming back, now in early May, and so they may not have just arrived in force yet. But in most cases, orioles and hummingbirds will get along fine, and you know, you could put up like a couple of additional hummingbird feeders so that there are more choices for the birds. But the orioles shouldn't keep the hummers away.
No, and you could even put up an oriole feeder or two to attract them to that feeder, because if you've got a feeder with a couple of orange halves on it and some grape jelly in the middle, they'll go right to that, I'm pretty sure. And they'll probably leave the hummingbird feeder alone.
Or least go add it to the repertoire. But yeah, the half an orange stuck out there. Maybe it's because it's the same color as the Orioles, but it really will attract them.
We've got a half dozen Orioles at our Oriole feeders right now, and they come the 1st of May, just like clockwork, to our area. Well, your folks had feeders, did they not? Or did you run those feeders at all, or was it your mom or your dad that did that?
Well, you know, when I was a kid, I was this totally rabid, crazed little bird watcher, and I put bird feeders out in the corner of the yard where they weren't really that easy to watch from the windows of the house, and I would go out and lie in the bushes and watch the feeders, but then I would be overcome with this sense that, oh, you know, I'm a real serious brooder, and I shouldn't be watching feeders, and so I wouldn't fill them. And it was after I left home, really after I was out traveling, and my, you know, I'd left my parents with some peace and quiet, but they put up bird feeders of their own right outside the windows, and it's like they became interested in birds after I left.
Oh, interesting. Virginia in Milwaukee, it's your turn. Hi, Virginia.
Good morning to you and your guest. I wanted to just mention this robin, and this robin is almost about as big as a chicken over here. He is big. Well, I'm on the 3rd floor, and I have a balcony in an apartment, and this robin decided to see what was happening here in my apartment, and I had my drapes opened, and I have a screen, of course, the sliding screen, and then the sliding window so I can walk out there. And this robin kept looking in here, sitting on the little railing, and he decided, this was just yesterday, he decided that he was going to try to fly in here. So I thought that perhaps one try, you know, that would be enough.
No.
But this guy kept trying, and I thought, what am I going to do? So I kept thinking of ways that maybe I could. See, I have plants here, and I don't know if you can see them through the window. I have a couple of ficus trees, and they're pretty tall. They're about 6 feet tall. And so I decided, he got to the left side, and he tried it over there about 5-6 times, and then, you know, I thought, well, maybe he's getting a little dizzy here, you know, bumping his head. And he'd go back to the railing each time, try again.
I think what he was, he probably wasn't looking at the ficus trees, Ken, was he?
I would guess that he was maybe seeing his reflection in the window and was thinking that was some sort of a rival robin and was flying over there to try to drive it away. Would that be a possibility?
Well, we have a bird feeder, and I go out and I fill that every night so that they have it early in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
And, excuse me, it was a promise I made to my mother before she passed that I would continue to feed her friends. And getting back to the robin, he decided to try the other side of the door because it's about 12 feet wide, my patio door here. So he tried the other side, came back, tried the other side, and flew against it about five, six times again. And I thought, okay, now let's see, what can I do? So I thought, I'll just put the tree right in front of the, I'll open up the door completely, and I'll put I'll move the tree over and put it right in front so that maybe he'll land in it. And so then he did come back eventually again, and he was sitting there and just looking, and he got so close to the area where he could fly in, but he couldn't figure it out. He was real close to it. So, but I think he's still out there. He's a neighborhood robin, you might say.
My guess is he's probably looking at his reflection in the window and thinking he's got a rival. And he's, you know, it's that time of the year for those male robins to be kind of protecting their territory. But it's a good story. And, you know, Ken, you write in your book about birders who, when they've been doing it for a long time, some birders start to look with a less than, sort of a blasé attitude toward maybe the robin, or as you write, I think the cardinal, because they've seen them so many times, and there's so many of them. And yet we ought to be glorifying and having a good time looking at those birds too, not necessarily the ones that maybe that are strange we see maybe once in our lifetime or once in a while.
Yeah, well, it's, you know, it's human nature to value the things that are rare But I don't know. I guess partly because I've been looking at birds for so long. I went through a phase where I was sort of bored with the common birds, but I've come back around to really appreciating them. And I really encourage people to. I mean, the robin is. It's a beautiful bird. It's got a wonderful, rich caroling song. It's got rich colors. And if it were a rare bird, you know, the bird watchers would go climb mountains to see it, and they'd be celebrating like crazy when they actually caught up to it.
Ken Kaufman, our guest today, ornithologist, author of several books, including the one we're talking about today. It's called Flights Against the Sunset. I'm really pleased to have him with us, published by Houghton Mifflin. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking about birds today and the travels and tales of an ornithologist. And that ornithologist is Ken Kaufman, author of Flights Against the Sunset. If you have some questions or comments for him as we move along today, you're most welcome to join in. If you're in the Madison area, reach us at 263-1890, 263-1890. Anywhere else, it's toll free at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call with your questions and with your comments. Ken, you mentioned the song of the robin. It is a beautiful song, and you write in your book about the bird that you think has the prettiest song. What's that bird? And tell us that story a little bit.
It's a bird called the kokako, and it's found only in New Zealand. And a lot of the birds that live in New Zealand have become relatively rare over the last century. New Zealand, originally, before human settlement, it had no real predators on land, and so the birds there tended to be pretty tame, and they were very much adapted to the habitat there. And after, when the Maori people moved in, many centuries ago, some of the larger birds disappeared pretty promptly. But then when European man arrived there, there was like wholesale loss of native habitats and native birds, partly because the Europeans brought in all these European birds that reminded them of home. And so you travel around in New Zealand and you see all, you know, the same sorts of birds you'd see in France. The native birds there are becoming hard to find, but this kokako is, it's a big bird. It's close to the size of a crow, and it's gray with these blue wattles at the corner of the bill. It's a very weird-looking thing. It goes bounding around in the trees, acting sort of like a squirrel leaping from one branch to the next, and when it flies, it's sort of a, you can hear the loud rustling of its wings. It's not a very good flyer, but the song is amazing. It's got this rich song. You can hear it singing two notes at once. It's singing chords and not just single notes. And it does, it's almost like it's sitting at a church organ and improvising and doing these sort of soft phrases and little musical melodies. And it's the most amazing bird song I've ever heard.
Oh, and you got a recording of it, so you're lucky. You get to listen to it once in a while.
Yeah, it's just an amazing thing, and there are bird conservation workers in New Zealand who are really dedicated people who are doing everything they can to preserve what's left of the native habitats there and the native birds. And I'm sure a song like that kokako song, is a real inspiration to them.
I'm sure it is. Laurie in Gladstone, Michigan, is up next. Let's go to Laurie. Hi, Laurie.
Hi. I was so happy I was home today and happened to catch your show with Ken. I'm a fan of Ken. I've read Kingbird Highway a number of years ago, and it's still one of my favorite books.
Oh, thank you.
So I just wanted to recommend that to everyone listening. Happy to hear you have something new out, so I'll definitely be looking for that.
Thank you very much for calling, Laurie.
Sure. Thank you.
Thanks. I appreciate that.
What's Kingbird Highway about, by the way, just so people know?
Kingbird Highway is a memoir also, but it ended before my 20th birthday. It's just talking about the things that I was doing in my late teens when I was hitchhiking around North America looking for birds.
That's a pretty cool book as well. Thanks again, Laurie, for bringing that up and reminding us about Kingbird Highway. Appreciate it very much. We have more callers online, and Bill in Bayfield County, I think, is up next. Hi, Bill.
Hi. My question was regard to the wind turbines, and, you know, we're going to see more of that. And I'm wondering how that affects the birds and their populations. I've heard both sides of the arguments, and I really, you know, haven't had a good answer yet.
Yeah, well, it is a controversial issue, partly because there are two sides to it. I mean, I'm definitely in favor of green energy and renewable energy that doesn't pollute, and so, you know, as in a general way, I'm all in favor of wind energy. I do think that placement of the turbines is really important. And there are, I mean, obviously there are some birds everywhere, and there's going to be a little bit of, you know, there will be some birds killed by any kind of tower or wind structure that's put up. But it's not going to be major numbers unless it's right in the middle of some major concentration point for migratory birds. And we're getting to the point now where we have pretty good information about that. And I just think, you know, at the moment, I don't know the situation in Wisconsin, but I know in Ohio we don't have any strong legislation yet for where these wind turbines are placed. And I do think that wildlife has to be taken into account in where wind farms are put up. Some places where they wouldn't cause that much damage, and some places where they would be a disaster.
Yeah. And there is some controversy, certainly as Bill was saying, both sides, two sides to this issue. I should mention that we're doing a program on wind power siting issues, pros and cons, on Thursday, May 29th, just so people know. It's coming up toward the end of the month. We'll be doing that particular show. So if you're strongly interested in the wind power turbine issue, I hope you'll be sure to mark that on your calendar and tune in that particular day. Thanks again, Bill, for calling. And Jay in Baraboo is up next. Jay, hello to you.
I'm great. Thank you very much for taking my call. I love your program.
Thank you.
And speaking of kingbirds, I had a magnificent eastern kingbird in my front yard this morning. It was very thrilling to see him.
Wow, great.
I don't see them very often, but it's really exciting when I do.
Oh, sure.
So my question is, I had my husband put up a number of bluebird boxes last year. And I've actually had some tree swallows nesting in some of them. I've been successful in attracting a couple of bluebirds into the houses. But I have the bluebird box sparrow problem. So I didn't have the heart to tear out the nests last year. So I have now, I think, a set of sparrows who are determined to take up residence in a couple of my bluebird houses. Should I throw in the towel and just let them live there, or should I come up with some sort of a plan?
Well, you know, that's very much a personal choice, but in your situation, I would just keep removing the house sparrow nesting material. I mean, it's a lot of work, but if you just go out and keep throwing out their nesting material, then eventually they'll give up and find another spot. And it's not like you're going to be destroying their chances of nesting, because house sparrows are very adaptable, and they'll find another spot. But the bluebirds and the tree swallows are a lot more exacting and demanding on where they're going to nest. So you can really help those birds by just taking the extra trouble to throw out the house sparrow nests.
I had some very, I don't know how you might term them, but they were very persistent sparrows that were trying to nest inside of one of my bird feeders inside the cone shell, and I had to pull that out every day. I finally, instead of just doing it every day, I had my father-in-law come up with a new bird feeder that he made one for me that the birds couldn't get into and make their nest, so I solved the problem that way. But they really are persistent, and you've got to keep at them if you want to get them out. Thanks a lot, Jay. Joy, for calling.
Another question would be if I keep pulling the nesting material out of that box, is there any risk that they'll be challenging the other birds that have established themselves in the other houses?
Once the birds are actually established in the other houses, it's not likely that the sparrows would drive them out. I mean, they're you know, weird things happen, but it's sort of at the stage when they're just getting established that the sparrows are most likely to drive them out. And once bluebirds or swallows actually have eggs in there, eggs are young, it's a lot less likely that the sparrows are going to be able to evict them.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Just back to the book for a minute, and I'm not sure that we really covered this so people can understand how your book is made up. But just talk about the makeup of your book.
Okay, well, there are a couple of ways of looking at it. But the sort of, in a nutshell, it describes a day when I went back to visit. My mother was ill, and she was confined to the hospital. And I went back to visit her. My three brothers were all living there in Wichita, Kansas, where she was. But I was at that point living 1,000 miles away, and so I would make trips there every few weeks to visit with her. And so the story that's told in the book is one long day where I'm sitting and talking with her, and she's asking me about, she wants to know about my latest experiences and what I've been seeing in the way of birds. And so I start telling her these stories. She was in a certain amount of pain and discomfort, and so I was trying to keep her distracted by just telling her things that would hold her interest. So I wasn't talking about, like, dry details of ornithology. It was more like the more interesting experiences of, you know, where birds and bird watchers intersect and the interesting things that happen there.
Yeah. And you, in your own experiences, I mean, you've led nature tours to all the continents, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh, yes, that's right.
And the experiences that you share in some of those chapters is amazing. What are the people like is there a type of person who goes on a journey like that with you?
Well, I was leading tours, leading nature tours and birdwatching tours to make a living for quite a while before I got too busy with writing projects. And one thing that was great about it was that the people, you know, birdwatchers tend to be very fun, interesting people, and they're sort of open and outgoing and ready to go have new experiences. And so I could take a group to someplace like East Africa or New Zealand or Peru, and it would be an even better experience than if I were just going by myself, because I'd be traveling essentially with a bunch of friends and people who are just very intensely curious and interested about everything that was going on.
Yeah, I think your lead story, or one of your lead stories anyway, is with the Baird Bird Club from Reading, Pennsylvania, where you took them to Venezuela, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, that was a private tour for the one bird club. And so occasionally that would happen where it would be just a group of local friends, like this group from Pennsylvania. And other times it would be just people would sign up from all over. And so you'd have, yeah, we'd have a group from all over the U.S. and Canada and maybe from Britain as well.
Yeah, interesting. Weldon in Oshkosh, we'll give you a chance now. Hi, Weldon.
Hi. I'm calling about the whippoorwill. It's a bird that I remember hearing from when I was a teenager until I was in my 50s, and suddenly one summer it wasn't to be heard from again. I'm interested in knowing what can be done to encourage their return and what might have been responsible for their disappearance.
All right, Ken?
Yeah, well, whippoorwills are, you know, they're wonderful birds, members of the nighthawk or nightjar family that call at night with that really rich whippoorwill-type call. Their numbers have declined in a number of parts of eastern North America. They like really extensive forested areas. You need to have really a large tract of forest for them to be successful in nesting. And so in some places they disappear just because the forest has become too fragmented, too broken up. In other places it's just simple loss of habitat. But then there are some other places where their numbers have declined and we don't really know why. So a lot would depend on the local situation there.
Yeah, a lot of it probably habitat loss plays as big a role as anything, I would think, here in Wisconsin at least. Well, then, thank you. Rich in Green Bay, it's your turn. Hi, Rich. Thanks for calling.
Hello. I want to talk about suet, but I wanted to also say that I had Orioles this weekend, so it's not too early to put out your oranges and grape jelly.
No, it sure isn't.
Suet, is there a certain season that the birds like the suet, and what types of birds would need the suet, say, and what would your recommendations be? I haven't been very successful feeding suet.
Yeah, well, I haven't been too successful with pure suet, partly because I'm lazy and I don't go to the trouble of going and, you know, like getting it from a butcher stand or something. But these days there are various kinds of suet cakes that are manufactured that you can get from wild bird stores, things like that. And I find that birds come to that stuff all year round. They're it's primarily the insect-eating birds that will attract woodpeckers and chickadees and nuthatches, birds like that. But if you get like a little wire cage of some sort and put in one of these manufactured suet cakes, the birds will go for that. You can also just get, if you go to a butcher stand and get, you know, beef fat, get suet, you can put that out. But it tends to go bad pretty quickly in warm weather, so it's less... less of a desirable thing in summer.
So it is year-round type of a feed.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, I have mine out year-round, and they're, you know, these cakes come with some with nuts and some with fruits. There's a pretty broad range of suet cakes that you can and buy these days, and they're usually, I don't know, 90 cents a piece or something like that, or a buck maybe.
Yeah, I've been trying those. They're just not having a lot of success recently, but... Squirrels like them, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, they sure do.
That's another reason to have a good solid wire cage to put them inside.
Yeah. I have a feeder that, of suet feeder that actually is, hangs from a chain, and it's a little rooftop, and the cage is underneath the rooftop, and you put it in, and the squirrels have a lot harder time standing upside down to get at the suet, and that seems to work pretty well, and the birds don't mind at all. The birds they'll go right underneath and sit upside down and peck away at that suet without any trouble at all. And it saves raccoons too. The old system I had, the raccoons would love to come in and pull down the entire structure and take the cake apart and eat it. Oh, man. Tom and Mequon, your turn. Hi, Tom.
Hello. Hi. I was wondering, I've got a question about some birds that I hear in the evening.
Yes, go ahead.
Well, my first question is that I've got a little bit of a lowland next to me, and I hear the tadpoles making noise, and I also hear what sounds like a bird that makes just a single note, and if they seem to be living near where these tadpoles are, and I was wondering if you'd have an idea what that would be. And you can hear them really any time of the night. And the other thing is there's another bird sound that I hear that's also a single note, but it's louder, and it's just like a and that's in the evening too. And I was wondering if you'd know anything about, you know, birds that would make a sound like that.
Yeah, I'm not so sure they're birds, but Ken, what do you think?
Yeah, if it's a single note call that you hear all night, I would wonder about the possibility of it being like spring peeper, which is a small frog.
That and as a matter of fact, your little whistle there sounded a lot to me like a spring peeper, Tom.
Because I can get them to call back to me after a while. If I mimic them, they'll call back to me after a while. And it's funny, too, because there may be 8 or 10 of them, and after a while, they'll, like, all be almost in harmony as they call back. I can get them to call back, like, every 5 seconds.
More likely, do birds sing very much at night, Ken?
Most kinds don't. There are a few that will be pretty vocal at night, but you wouldn't have that many of them in a small area. So I would guess... you know, some kind of frog would be the most likely explanation.
Yeah, I think so too, Tom. Pretty sure. If you can record it, send me the recording. You could even, you know, you can email that recording, send it to the station, and I'll listen to it. But I'll also let somebody who really knows what they're doing listen to it too, and see if we can get you an identification. My guess: spring peepers. Mike in Eau Claire, it's your turn. Hi, Mike.
Good morning. A couple of things. The comment about whippoorwills. I live south of Eau Claire. Have been here for 4 years, and every summer we've had a whippoorwill. Never saw it, but we hear it every night. Haven't heard it yet this year, but a good part of the summer. Mm-hmm. And then the person that called about suet. Last week we have, as your guest said, woodpeckers and chickadees and nuthatches year round, but. Last week, a Tennessee warbler showed up, and then a bunch of yellow-rumped warblers, and they've been on the suet every day.
Wow, that's great. That's great. I mean, warblers will occasionally go to those things, but it's sort of an acquired taste for them. And it's like, especially if you have some cold weather, they'll be more willing to experiment. So, yeah, pine warbler is another one that will come to suet cakes. But, you know, you're very lucky to have that happen.
Yeah, it's delightful. And the yellow rump just continue to stay here. And then also we had our first hummingbird and our first oriole Sunday, so it's been a good spring so far.
Oh, sounds like it. Yeah, thanks, Mike. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And, you know, the backyard, you talk a little bit about the backyard. I had Bill Thompson on my show last week, who I know you know pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
And we were talking about his new book, his book for young birders. And as we talked, I got to thinking about the number of species of birds, and I had another birder on as well, who's from Madison. He said, you probably, in the course of a year, will get maybe 60 species of birds to your backyard. And so there's a lot to see right in your own backyard if you pay attention.
Oh, there really is. I mean, there's a whole world of stuff to discover out there. And, you know, you can also use the backyard as sort of a springboard to going out and discovering things about the world. But the things that are going on with bird life around the world are sort of echoed in a small way, even in a small yard.
Yeah, absolutely. Mike, I thank you again for calling. Appreciate it. And Ken, it's been a real pleasure to be able to talk with you today. And I enjoyed your book very much, and I'll look forward to another. Are you going to come back to Wisconsin anytime soon?
I'm hoping to. I may not make it this year, but perhaps by next spring sometime.
Well, let me know.
Great.
All right.
Well, thanks, Larry.
Thanks a lot, Ken. Ken Kaufman, ornithologist and author of many books, including the book we just heard about. It's called Flights Against the Sunset, and it's published by Houghton Mifflin. Ken Kaufman, you can get it at go to your local bookstore. If they don't have it, they will order it. I'm sure of that. Well, coming up, we're going to be talking about some confusion, I think, that exists for many of us over sugars and carbohydrates. Sue Nitzke, professor in the Department of Nutritional Sciences at UW-Madison, our guest coming up next here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.